So the general theme for the talk tonight is Evolution, Capitalism and Buddhism. And a subtitle for it is Charles Darwin, Adam Smith and the Buddha. And so, without further ado, I'll plunge in. So as most of you, I think, will know, the Buddha lived between 500 and 400 BCE in northern India. And the German philosopher Karl Jaspers identified the Buddha as one of the profoundly wise people of what he called the Axial Age. And the Axial Age was a period roughly between 800 and 200 BCE in which emerged in different parts of the world what Karl Jaspers called profoundly wise people. So that we had the Hebrew prophets in the Middle East, we had Socrates, Plato and Aristotle in Greece, we had Confucius, for example, in China, and we had the Buddha in India. And you could say that these wise people of the Axial Age gave voice to a new stage in the evolution of the human species. They emphasized placing ethics at the center of the spiritual life in the pursuit of a new kind of humanity. And the issue arises, or the question arises, how did they come to exist at that time? And because I have a background in economics, of course, one of the reasons I thought they arose is in part due to the evolution of economic organization of society, such that by the Axial Age, in some societies at least, enough of an economic surplus existed to give some people time to reflect and ponder on life's meaning. Before that, people were always working. They had no time to reflect. When you look at the stories of the Buddha, you will see that in the Buddha's lifetime, the economy of the Ganges plain in which he walked and taught meant that he and many other holy wanderers could depend upon villagers and townspeople for their food and sometimes for their shelter. The society had developed enough economically to support a very large population of holy wanderers. But for 2,000 years from the time of the Buddha, there was very little change in the level of economic output or in the standard of living of people around the world. For much of that time, for 2,000 years, simply because they contained more people than any other regions, India and China were the world's biggest economies. And then, sometime during the 16th to 18th centuries, came a series of changes in conditions in Western Europe that led to the emergence of the economic system we know as capitalism. So after a long period of relative economic stability, the world economy underwent a profound change, with an astonishing growth in output and standards of living, leading to better healthcare, better education, and longer lives. A truly dramatic change over the last 200 to 300 years. But I would argue that now we have reached an impasse of increasing inequality, relatively high levels of unemployment, especially among young people, threats to the environment, threats even to the existence of species, because of a neoliberal form of capitalism that has come to dominate the world over the last 35 years. If you want to put a time when the economic world changed, it changed with the election in the UK of Margaret Thatcher and the election in the United States of Ronald Reagan. So over the last 35 years, a neoliberal form of economics, a neoliberal form of capitalism, has come to dominate the world. So in this talk, I want to explore the links between evolution, capitalism, and Buddhism. And my hope is that this exploration will help to open up a discussion as to how our economic system can evolve beyond the current trap of neoliberal capitalism, to help reduce suffering and to help all individuals in the world to fulfill their potential in harmony with the environment. And in particular, I want to explore the ideas of three people: the Buddha, a man called Adam Smith, a Scottish moral philosopher, whose book called The Wealth of Nations was published at the end of the 18th century in 1776. And this is seen as the first and still as one of the most important books on the economics of capitalism. So that's the second person, Adam Smith. And thirdly, Charles Darwin, whose Origin of the Species, published in 1859, expounded his theory of evolution. And I hope to draw out two themes common to the thinking of the Buddha, Adam Smith, and Charles Darwin. The first theme is this: there are two conflicting sides to human nature, one driven by greed and self-interest, and the other filled with kindness, generosity, and selflessness. And the second theme is that things happen in dependence upon conditions. And I'll explain more about that later. So I hope to draw out those two themes by looking at these three people. And I'm going to start by looking at Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution. So Darwin's theory of evolution is strongly associated in people's minds with the phrase survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest. In fact, Darwin did not use the term survival of the fittest until the fifth edition of his book on the Origin of Species. Before that, he used the term natural selection. And Darwin borrowed the phrase survival of the fittest from a man called Herbert Spencer. And Herbert Spencer was associated with economic theories supportive of unrestrained capitalism. And because of this, Darwin inadvertently encouraged a narrow interpretation of his theory by economists and by others. And so the word fittest came to be associated with the strongest, the most selfish, and the greediest. Actually, Darwin didn't mean that at all by the survival of the fittest. He simply meant that those best fitted or suited to their environment would be the ones that would survive and flourish. And in reality, in any case, Darwin had a view of evolution, a much broader view of evolution, that did not just depend on the selfish individual. He wrote another book called The Descent of Man, in which he argued the human species has succeeded because of characteristics like sharing and compassion. He wrote, "Those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish best and rear the greatest number of offspring." By sympathetic, he meant something closer in our terms to empathic. The most empathic members, then those communities would flourish best. And more fully he wrote, "Although a high standard of morality gives only a slight or no advantage to each individual man and his children over men of the same tribe, an advancement in the standard of morality will certainly give an immense advantage to one tribe over another. A tribe including many members who, from possessing a high degree of spirit of patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, were always ready to aid one another and to sacrifice themselves for the common good, that tribe would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. In other words, according to Darwin, natural selection operated at the level of the individual and at the level of the group. And Darwin described clearly two sides to human nature: the selfish individual seeking to outdo others within their group, and the compassionate, empathic individual cooperating with others for the benefit and the success of their group. Nevertheless, that phrase, survival of the fittest, caused a lot of damage. And the link between economics and the survival of fittest, in the sense of the strongest and most selfish, was established. And this misconception of Darwin's ideas linked in very well with something written by Adam Smith in his book The Wealth of Nations, published at the end of the 18th century. It fitted in with something that Adam Smith called the invisible hand. And if you listen to advocates of modern neoliberal capitalism and free market economics, you will often hear them talking about this idea of the invisible hand. It sits at the core of their economic beliefs, although in fact Adam Smith only mentions it once in the book The Wealth of Nations. This is what Adam Smith wrote: "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages." And he continued, "Every individual necessarily labours to render the annual revenue of the society as great as he can. He generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it. He intends only his own gain, and he is, in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectively than when he really intends to promote it." In other words, Smith is arguing that what motivated the butcher, the brewer, or the baker, what drives them, is their own self-interest, their own profit. And this, he says, is a good thing, because as long as every individual in society pursues their own gain or profit, chases after their own self-interest, then through the working of the market, everyone in society benefits. And all of this comes about through the operation of an invisible hand. Now, with this book, it could be argued that Adam Smith did more than anyone else to make capitalism and the pursuit of unhindered self-interest respectable. And from the modern presentation of Adam Smith's ideas by neoliberal and other economists, you could be forgiven for thinking that that is all there is to Adam Smith. But if that's what you think, you're wrong. Because 17 years before the publication of the book The Wealth of Nations, he published a very different book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And in this book, it could be argued, he wrote as eloquently as anyone has ever done on the futility of pursuing money with the hope of finding happiness. In this book, he reveals a different view of human motivation. In the opening lines of the book, he wrote this: "However selfish a man may be, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others, and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. In the book, he expounded a theory of sympathy, again, closer in meaning to our modern word empathy, in which he argued that our fellow feeling for the misery of others is founded on our imaginative capacity for changing places in our imagination with the sufferer. Now, when I read these words, what struck me was that they were very familiar. And they were familiar because of a book called the Bodhisharya Avatara, The Way of the Bodhisattva, by the Indian Buddhist Shantideva, in which he talks at one stage about exchange of self and other. And Adam Smith, without knowing anything about Buddhism, had a similar kind of idea. He understood that people's behavior is not just dictated by self-interest, but derives from a variety of motives. Like Charles Darwin, Adam Smith understood that there are two sides to human nature: the selfish, self-interested side, and the kind and compassionate side. Nevertheless, modern economics is gripped by the view that the pursuit of selfishness promotes the well-being of the whole of society. This is the mantra that has become the core ethic of modern capitalism. It's the ethic that supersedes all other ethical considerations. You may have heard of the Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He's a very prominent voice speaking in opposition to dominant economic ideas. He said this about this idea of selfishness promoting the well-being of the whole of society. He said this: "To the morally uninspired, it's an appealing idea. Selfishness as the ultimate form of selflessness." Selfishness as the ultimate form of selflessness. In other words, it doesn't matter how selfish you are being. It doesn't even matter how unethical you are being in the pursuit of selfishness. You are working for the well-being of all. And it excuses, of course, all sorts of behaviour. So lying behind much of current economics is the belief that human beings are naturally and rationally selfish, and to power an economy requires the promotion of selfishness and greed. And this belief in the power of greed and selfishness takes support from some scientists like Richard Dawkins. In his book, The Selfish Gene, Dawkins writes, "Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish." So the core idea behind Dawkins' words, one that lies behind the emphasis on selfishness in modern economics, is that unselfishness or altruism is somehow less natural than selfishness. Now, Richard Dawkins' ideas have not gone unchallenged. There are other evolutionary biologists who oppose them, particularly a man called E.O. Wilson and another man called David Sloan Wilson. And they argue that altruism too has a natural evolutionary basis. They say that altruism is equally natural because, although it is true that within groups, natural selection might favour characteristics that are selfish, when groups start to compete with one another, those groups who contain more unselfish, cooperative and altruistic members will outcompete other groups in the survival stakes. They call this the multi-level selection theory of evolution. It's clearly returning to the original idea of Charles Darwin's observation about the success of the human species being related to the ability to cooperate. It's worth taking a little time to hear how David Wilson explains the theory. He says this: life consists of units within units. In the biological world, we have genes, individuals, groups, species, and ecosystems, all nested within the biosphere. In the human world, we have genes, individuals, families, villages and cities, provinces and nations, all nested within the global village. In both worlds, a problem lurks at every rung of the ladder, a potential conflict between the interests of the lower level units and the welfare of the higher level units. And he expresses it this way in relation to the human world: what's good for me is not necessarily good for my family. What's good for my family is not necessarily good for my clan. What's good for my clan is not necessarily good for my nation. What's good for my nation is not necessarily good for the global environment or economy. So we have a conflict between lower level selfishness and higher level welfare. And you can see this, he says, in the biological world. So cancer cells selfishly spread at the expense of other cells within the body, without contributing to the common good, ultimately potentially resulting in the death of the whole organism. In many animal societies, the dominant individuals act more like tyrants than wise leaders, taking as much as they can for themselves until they are deposed by the next tyrant. Single species can ravage entire ecosystems for nobody's benefit but their own. But every once in a while, Wilson argues, the good manage to decisively suppress selfishness within their ranks. Then something extraordinary happens. The group becomes a higher level organism. So he says, in terms of biology, nucleated cells did not evolve by small mutational steps from bacterial cells, but as groups of cooperating bacteria. Likewise, multicellular cellular organisms are groups of highly cooperative cells, and the insects of social insect colonies, while physically separate, coordinate their activities so well that they qualify as superorganisms. And Wilson tells us human evolution represents a similar transition. And there's a very good account of how this transition might have happened by an evolutionary anthropologist called Christopher Boehm. So he argued that our ancestors' survival became a team activity probably around a quarter of a million years ago, when it was discovered that driving big animals towards teammates yielded more meat than solo hunting. So that teamwork yielded more success in terms of kills and getting more meat than solo hunting. But for this approach to survive required more than just a new way of cooperative hunting. It required also an acceptable and consistent way of dividing up and distributing the spoils of the hunt. So in a way, what he's describing is an economic problem. How do you get production? By cooperation. How do you distribute the product? And he goes on to explain how that was done. He said, by studying modern day hunter-gatherers, those that remain, you can see that rules and practices must have developed to ensure a more egalitarian approach, both in the hunt itself and in the distribution of the spoils of the hunt. So he says that when you observe modern hunter-gatherers, what you notice is, first of all, is that they are particularly watchful for any tendency for individuals to free ride. In other words, they watch out very much for any individuals who try to take a share of the hunt without actually participating in the hunt itself. And they also watch out very carefully for stronger individuals trying to claim more share than others. They don't allow either to happen. And they do this by developing social rules so that those best at cooperating better fare better than those who act selfishly. So, for example, a simple rule. If there's a kill and there's meat, meat is not distributed by the individual who makes the actual kill, but by another member of the group. Those who step out of line are ridiculed and shamed and shunned and even exiled, which would effectively mean that they would die. So there's a lot of social rules develop to ensure that people cooperate. And these social rules create a very powerful pressure in favour of preemptive self-control. People want to avoid being socially penalised. So people start to behave in the way that avoids social penalties. And in this way, he argues, the pressure for self-control shaped our moral sense, internalizing behavioral rules such that certain behaviors came to feel clearly right or clearly wrong. And he said, shame and guilt, the sense of shame and guilt that we have, emerged as evolutionary signals of this process. So our previously fear-based social order changed to one where social selection for collaborative activities became dominant. So those who had a reputation of being poor cooperators would not be selected for joint ventures. In particular, they would not be selected for raising new humans. So in this way, we bred ourselves for cooperation because of the interaction between the development of cultural rules and human breeding, altruistic tendencies were strengthened and became part of our evolutionary inheritance. So we had this interplay between genetic and cultural evolution. And this is important because just like genetic traits, cultural traits can spread, and they can spread by benefiting lower level units at the expense of higher level units. They can spread in a way that contributes to the higher level good. So they can have pluses or minuses. He says there can be cultural cancers, no less so than genetic cancers. That's quite a powerful statement, isn't it? There can be cultural cancers, no less so than genetic cancers. And so for teamwork to survive and to exist at any given level or rung of the social ladder, there must be mechanisms that hold the wolves of selfishness at bay, that hold the cultural cancers at bay. So a nation, he says, or the global village, is no different in this respect than a human village, a hunter-gatherer group, an ant colony, a multicellular organism, or a nucleated cell. So that we need protections, rules and protections for natural selection to work in a positive and progressive way. I'll return to that theme later, towards the end of the talk. So you might think, well, okay, how does the Buddha relate to all this? We've talked about Charles Darwin and Adam Smith and evolution. How does the Buddha relate to all this discussion? Well, we know very clearly the Buddha identified greed, hatred, and delusion as the root causes of the human predicament. They are the root causes of our suffering. Greed, hatred, and delusion are there in us as the root causes of the human predicament. We are born with the potential for greed, hatred, and delusion. But, the Buddha said, of course, we are also born with the potential for generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. And which potential dominates depends upon what we turn our minds towards and what we cultivate in our lives. So the Buddha, like the other sages of the Axial Age, emphasized placing ethics at the center of life. And like the other people of the Axial Age, he said that empathy and compassion have to be developed, while greed and egotism, violence and unkindness must be shaken off. And very important, compassion and altruism should not be confined to one's own people, but instead should be extended beyond. We teach metta, loving kindness. The Buddha prescribed the practice of metta, the practice of loving kindness, towards all living creatures found in nature. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha asks us to cultivate the following intention. Whatsoever living beings exist, without exception, whether weak or strong, whether tall and large, middle-sized or short, whether very subtle or very gross, whether visible or invisible, dwelling far away or not far away, whether born already or not yet born, may all beings be happy in themselves. So the Buddha is enjoining us to practice metta, to practice loving kindness towards all living creatures. The Buddha is asking us to direct our metta, our loving kindness, towards those not yet born, towards future generations of humans and of other species. We are being asked to act with kindness towards our descendants and the descendants of other species. So the metta bhavana is an attitude, the cultivation of loving kindness is an antidote for hatred. And the antidote for greed is generosity, the practice of giving. The Buddha once commented, "Those who do not praise giving are fools." And when you read the teachings of the Buddha, you see very clearly that the practice of giving, of generosity, is the foundation and the seed of spiritual development. When you read the stories, the early stories of the Buddha's teachings in the Pali Canon, you read time and time again that talk on giving was the first topic to be discussed by the Buddha whenever he was teaching. And Sangharakshita, who founded the Triratna Buddhist Order and the Triratna Buddhist community, commented that it's as if the teaching is saying this: you may not be morally scrupulous, you may not be able to meditate even for 5 minutes at a time, you may not dip into the scriptures from 1 year to the next, but if you aspire to lead any sort of higher life, then at the very least you will give. So the practice of generosity is vital in directly debilitating greed. So the Buddha is telling us that if we wish to fulfill our progressive evolutionary potential, then we need to cultivate loving kindness and generosity. We need to cultivate an ethical path of care and compassion that we follow, not just at the level of the individual, important though that is, but we follow and try to implement at all other levels of the society that we live in and of the world. But there's another teaching of the Buddha, I think, which has a lot of bearing on this issue of evolution and capitalism and Buddhism, and has a lot of bearing on how we might respond to our economic and social situation. And this is the teaching in Sanskrit. It's known as Pratichyat Samuppada. It means basically conditionality or conditioned arising. It's, if you like, I think this is the core Buddhist teaching. is like a natural law that operates at all levels of existence, from the physical material level or order through to the level on which a Buddha is said to act out of wisdom and compassion for the benefit of other beings. And the most succinct statement of this principle is given like this: this being that becomes, with the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not become, with the ceasing of this that ceases. Sounds very simple, but it's also very profound. It's telling us that everything in our experience exists in dependence upon conditions. Nothing exists completely separately from everything else. Nothing is fixed and permanent. What we think of as things are in reality processes which exist in dependence upon other processes and which themselves create the conditions for other processes to exist. So we live in an interconnected world of changing conditions. And if the conditions are right, then something new can emerge. And the whole process of evolution, which I described earlier, is an example of conditioned arising at work. If you change the conditions, if you change the environment, then the path of evolution changes. Christopher Boehm's description of a new way of hunting shows how, as a consequence, altruism and cooperation came to be a natural part of the human evolutionary inheritance. And economic development and the emergence of capitalism is another example of conditioned arising at work. As I said earlier, for 2,000 years after the death of the Buddha, very little changed in the world economy. Very little changed in the level of output and in the standard of living of people around the globe. But then, sometime in the 16th and 17th centuries, conditions changed so that capitalism could emerge. Now, exactly what conditions changed and what really mattered in the emergence of capitalism is very hotly debated. So some stress the so-called Protestant work ethic, the rise of Protestantism and an attitude towards work that helped the emergence of capitalism. Some stress the creation in some European states of new forms of government, of the emergence of proto-democratic systems of government. And they mixed with a benevolent self-interest. This is what's argued. Others emphasize something much darker. They emphasize the wealth, the huge amount of wealth that poured into Europe by the forcible removing of native peoples off their land in the Americas and in Africa. So Native Americans were dispossessed of their land, and about 12 million Africans were shipped from what 12 million Africans were shipped from one side of the Atlantic to the other. Earlier this year, I was in Liverpool, and I wandered along the shore at Liverpool, the seafront, and there you see these magnificent old buildings, wonderful buildings. And they are buildings, they're magnificent buildings, built basically on the proceeds of the slave trade. And it's quite a reminder of how the emergence of capitalism in the northwest of England was inextricably linked with the slave trade. And others emphasize other things, like the emergence of a new kind of financial system, new kinds of banking, new kinds of ways of financing companies. So, but however you view the importance of particular conditions in the emergence of capitalism, it's clear that a variety of conditions came together, and out of those conditions arose a new and very dynamic form of economic system we know as capitalism. Now, however much people might speak of unregulated or unrestrained capitalism. Of course, people and governments devised rules and regulations that allowed the development of capitalism. Capitalism depended upon the development of rules and regulations by people and governments. Just as people and governments devise rules and regulations that allow the current form of neoliberal capitalism to dominate and rule the world. So rules and regulations, agreements at local, national and international levels are part of the conditions that determine how our economic system evolves. Sometimes beneficially, sometimes not beneficially, to the future of humanity and of the planet. So as David Wilson reminded us, there can be cultural cancers, no less than genetic cancers, and for cooperation and altruistic teamwork to exist and to allow economic organisation to work for the benefit of humankind and of the planet, there must be mechanisms that hold the wolves of selfishness at bay. Unfortunately, in respect of what could be seen as an example of a cultural cancer, and by that I mean the modern multinational corporation, it might seem an extreme description, but I'll explain why I'm talking about it as a cultural cancer. Unfortunately, what are we seeing right now in terms of rules and regulations? Instead of mechanisms to hold the wolves of selfishness at bay, we see the creation of mechanisms that help the wolves of selfishness to dominate even more. So let me explain what I mean. The Buddha teaches us that our view of the self as fixed and unchanging and separate is false. We are not fixed and unchanging. We can change. We are not separate from everything else. So the Buddha says, by activating and cultivating our inherited tendency for generosity and kindness, we can go beyond our equally inherited tendencies for selfishness. We can change or evolve into individuals who realize that they, like all phenomena, are empty of fixed self-nature and are interconnected with all things. We can become enlightened because of the fact that we are not fixed and unchanging and separate. And the Buddha, the enlightened human being, stands as the symbol of the potential of human evolution. He embodies all the qualities of a human being who has evolved beyond selfishness. When you look at the creation of the corporation, especially the multinational corporation, what you see is that we have legally and financially created a selfish, profit-oriented organization that exists solely for the benefit of its shareholders. We have allowed to be designed an individual that is incapable of evolving beyond selfishness to loving kindness. An individual that is unlike other individuals in that it is capable of wielding enormous power around the globe. I have a friend called David Loy, an American Buddhist, who writes about issues of engaged Buddhism. He's written a very good book called Money, Sex, War, Karma, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution, which I highly recommend. And in that, he talks about the corporation, but how legally and financially the corporation is created in such a way that it cannot evolve from selfishness to loving kindness. And he encapsulates this with the phrase, the corporation cannot love. The corporation cannot love. So I would argue that if a higher or better level of economic organization is to emerge for the benefit of all, then the power of the multinational corporations has to be much better controlled by rules and regulations. And yet, what do we see happening right now? Well, in Europe, we have progress towards a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. And here in the Pacific area, I think you have what's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And these agreements, some of the agreements are secret, but though civil servants in Europe have revealed some of the terms of what's actually being kept secret. These agreements give multinational companies unprecedented powers. And according to Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, the intent of these agreements, what is contained in these partnership agreements, is to make very difficult and to impede health, environmental, safety and other regulations that individual countries might seek to implement to protect their own citizens. Under these agreements, companies can sue governments for full compensation for any reduction in their future expected profits which result from regulatory changes introduced in those countries. And that compensation will be determined by arbitrary panels that exist totally separate from any system of democratic accountability. And as Stiglitz says, this is not a theoretical possibility. Such agreements, similar agreements, already exist. So, you have Philip Morris, the tobacco manufacturer, is currently suing Uruguay and Australia. Why? Because Uruguay and Australia required warning labels to be put on cigarette packets. And both countries mandated, in some cases, the inclusion of graphic images showing the consequences of cigarette smoking on the packets. And the labelling is working. It is discouraging smoking. So now Philip Morris, through one of these unaccountable arbitration panels, is demanding to be compensated for lost profits. So instead of us, people in Australia or Uruguay, suing Philip Morris for the damage that they have caused through the sale of tobacco, actually the system is set up so that they can sue the countries and gain compensation for the loss of their profits. In Europe, you have the situation where a Swedish utility company called Vattenfall is suing Germany for nearly 5 billion euros over the closure of nuclear power plants. This follows the government's decision in Germany to withdraw from nuclear power in the wake of the Fukushima Daiichi accident in Japan. So Vattenfall, which ironically is part owned by the Swedish government, is actually suing the Germany for compensation for a decision to move away from nuclear power. So what this means is that in future, if we discover that some other product causes health problems and we want to do something to stop that product causing health problems, instead of us suing the manufacturer because of the damage caused to people, the manufacturer will be enabled to sue governments for the loss of their profits. In effect, the manufacturer, the multinational corporation, can sue because of legislation being introduced to stop them from killing more people. Now, it's crazy, isn't it? But this is what is going on. The same thing could happen if our governments impose more stringent regulations to protect us from the impact of greenhouse gas emissions. So, if we are to overcome the dangers of allowing an individual, like a corporation, to continue to act in a purely selfish and unethical way, then we need to seek different models of governance for corporations and much more vigorous regulation of corporations at both national and international levels in order to control their behaviour. And we need to ask for clarity and truthfulness in terms of what is really in these agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership. So as Buddhists, we teach and try to exemplify the practice of the five precepts or the five ethical guidelines. Not to harm other living beings, but to act with kindness. Not to take what has not been freely given, but to act with generosity. Not to indulge our desires, but to seek simplicity and contentment. Not to lie, but to speak truthfully and skillfully. Not to escape with intoxicants and drugs, but to engage mindfully with the world. But we cannot just practice these guidelines at the level of the individual, important foundation though that is. We must be prepared, I believe, to engage with higher levels of decision making and regulation setting at local, community, at national and international levels. If we are to allow the full evolution of the potential of humankind, and if we are to survive the current threat to the climate and to the environment, then we must oppose those regulations and laws that undermine the practice of ethics at whatever level of society. And we must promote and support those regulations and laws that support the practice of ethics at all levels of society and of the world. Buddhism is about wisdom and compassion. The Buddhist path requires transforming self and world. Thank you.